funding for THINK comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to THINK on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What really happened at the OK Corral in October of 1881? And what does the mythology that has sprung up around the story tell us about ourselves? The most famous gun battle in the history of the Old West is arguably also among the most mythologized. But as my guest today has discovered, the real documentable facts and the life stories of the major players, including Wyatt Earp, Doc Holliday, and their adversaries, are every bit as compelling as the legend spawned over more than a century of retelling. Author Jeff Gwynn shares the true story in his new book, The Last Gunfight, the real story of the shootout at the OK Corral and how it changed the American West. Jeff, welcome back to Think.
Thank you very much for letting me be on the show again.
Did you know starting out that, you know what, hang on a second, you are not on a connected microphone. Hold on one second. There we go. Okay, we got you now?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Did you know starting out in your research that what we think we know about the story was false, or did you sort of discover that along the way?
I think pretty much any iconic event in American history, there's some mythology involved with it. I had no idea what I was going to find, but what I really wanted to do was learn more about the settling of the frontier and use this event to sort of draw readers into that. What I didn't realize was that the truth about what happened that day was even better than the mythology and much more interesting.
So we were talking about this just before we went on the air, that the town of Tombstone is like the star character of this book. And of all the characters that have been mythologized, Tombstone was not a dusty little backwater. It was a big deal city. Two daily newspapers, lots of amenities.
Very much so. Tombstone was one of the most sophisticated cities perhaps in all of America, let alone the frontier. And that's because its silver mines attracted a lot of big investors, people who might come from San Francisco or New York to stay a while, and they were determined to have the same lifestyle they'd enjoyed back on the East or the West Coast. Tombstone had theaters that every night offered world-class entertainment, gourmet restaurants, the kind of shops that you'd find in the Galleria, let's say, in Houston or something of that nature. There were telephones in town, not many, but there were still the first models about the same time as the gunfight. The city council is arguing about how much to tax merchants for the sewer lines they're going to put in. It was a very vibrant, colorful place, and not at all like the dusty hamlets you see in movies.
Of course, with all that money comes a lot of conflict over money. How did those tend to play out?
The biggest surprise to me in the book, beyond Tombstone itself, mm-hmm. was that there were the same pressures, social, cultural, and political, that we find in America today. The rich investors in town were Republicans. They very much believed in strict law and order. The small ranchers in the San Pedro Valley, the cowboys, many of whom had been chased from Texas by the Texas Rangers, mm-hmm. who just didn't want them in our state anymore, are very, very violently Democrat. The party lines are drawn, and there's poison between them. There's no trust whatsoever. And a lot of the small ranchers are Southerners who've come to the frontier after the Civil War because they want to get away from what they see as government oppression. The Earps represent the businessmen. They are fervent Republicans. They want to move up in the world monetarily and socially. Enforcing the law, whether the cowboys like it or not, is the way they're going to do it. The cowboys are determined that they are not going to let anyone dictate how they live. And so it's built in this tension, and something had to happen sooner or later. And on October the 26th, 1881, it did.
And the seeds of that dream for the Earp family, and Wyatt Earp in particular, were planted by their father, who never did achieve the wealth and fame that he thought he deserved.
The Earps were your prototypical frontier family. For three generations, they kept moving farther and farther west, always hoping that they would come to a place where they could be the individuals of greatest importance, to have political power, to have some wealth. And it never really worked out. Wyatt's grandfather and father, occasionally filled an office of justice of the peace, so they could be called judge. But basically, they were farmers. Mm-hmm. Wyatt Earp and his brothers all had the same ambitions as their father and grandfather. The difference was that they came so tantalizingly close to getting what they wanted. In Tombstone, Virgil Earp became chief of police, and the title's important because the founding fathers of Tombstone didn't want a town sheriff. They saw chief of police just sounded so much better.
More urban.
Yes, very much so. Sophisticated. Wyatt dreamed of becoming the sheriff of newly created Cochise County, not because you got to enforce the law. You had your deputies for that. The sheriff of the county got to assess taxes and collect the taxes. And in Tombstone, in Cochise County, that meant silver mines, that meant importers, that meant fancy restaurant owners. And the county sheriff each year could collect about $400,000. And the 10% share to the sheriff would be $40,000, or in today's dollars, $900,000 a year. Is it any wonder that Wyatt was perfectly willing to run roughshod over some cowboys if that would impress the town leaders and hopefully get him the job?
Now, if he had been running for office in today's climate, where there are a lot of people looking into every little detail of one's background, he would not have even he couldn't have gotten enough people to sign the petition to put his name on the ballot. Talk a little bit about his history before he found his way to Tombstone, Arizona.
Let me preface this by saying that Wyatt was a man of his time on the frontier. And many young men, when they were trying to establish themselves, would be on different sides of the law at different points in their lives. Wyatt originally wanted to be important. It didn't matter how. In Missouri, he is a town constable. He marries the daughter of a hotel owner. It's going to be one of those happy young couples moving up in the world. She dies unexpectedly. Wyatt has to leave town quickly because there's an investigation as to whether the money that's filtering through his office is all being spent in the proper ways. He and an uncle were under suspicion, and after Wyatt skipped town, the uncle actually was on trial and found innocent, so Wyatt may have run for nothing. But he ran to Indian Territory, where he and two other men were arrested for horse theft. Wyatt was put in jail to await trial and broke jail. We found a newspaper article from the small town in Arkansas that laid the whole thing out. Technically, for the rest of his life, Wyatt Earp is a fugitive from justice. He ends up in Peoria, Illinois, where for a while he works as a bouncer in a floating house of ill repute. He's arrested a couple times and fined. And yet these are not things that necessarily brand him as a terrible person or even beyond the pale. From there, when he ends up in Wichita, Kansas, after a few stops as a buffalo hunter, he becomes a policeman. Wyatt never, ever headed a police department or sheriff's office himself. He was always an assistant. And in Wichita, his big job was getting dead animals off the sidewalk.
Which must have been a big deal at that time and place.
The people in Wichita liked him right up to the point where his boss was running for re-election. The boss's opponent claimed that the Earp brothers would all be given jobs on the police force if they won, and Wyatt, who had a bad temper, beat the man up and had to be fired. He ended up in Dodge City working as a deputy marshal. He put in some time as a bounty hunter. And then wanted to go to Tombstone, the boom area of the mall in the frontier at that time, thinking he'd start a stage line. He should have checked because when he got there, he found out there were already two. So he went to work for Wells Fargo. He had his ambition to be county sheriff. A colorful background, not to mention the four wives in his life, at least two of whom, shall we say, were ladies of a certain profession.
I thought a really interesting detail was that not only in certain municipalities was prostitution tolerated, but in fact it was heavily regulated and a pretty lucrative draw for the cities that would allow it.
Well, the towns knew that a lot of the men coming in, women being very scarce on the frontier, sure, would want a certain kind of companionship. For women out on the frontier on their own, it was a terribly hard life. There was nothing glamorous at all. And women who had to turn to prostitution were doing it to survive. The various boom towns would usually place an operating tax on the houses of ill repute, and the madam who ran them would have to sign documents and make everything formal.
And it says right on there, House of Ill Repute.
Right. I mean, there's no question. Mm-hmm. It was just good business. Like, you had to have some saloons in town, and you had to have some restaurants. You had to have some available ladies. And one of the things that Virgil Earp had to do in Tombstone was go around and collect the taxes. We have a funny notice in the photo section of The Last Gunfight of a certificate for one house of ill repute with Virgil writing that the woman would not pay and inquiring of the city council what they wanted him to do about it.
You know, it's interesting that Virgil Earp was the only one of the brothers that could rightfully be called a career lawman. That was his sole objective. Is that right?
I feel sorry for Virgil. Everybody remembers in terms of the gunfight at the O.K. Corral, which, by the way, did not happen in the O.K. Corral.
I know. It's like the city of Waco being branded forever with the Branch Davidian
right.
siege.
But on the other hand, in mythology, it wouldn't sound as good to say the shootout in the empty lot near but not in the O.K. Corral. Virgil was very happy mm-hmm. as a lawman. For Wyatt, it would have been a step to something more. Mm-hmm. Virgil was happy to be chief of police in Tombstone. He wanted to keep the job. The pressure on Virgil on that day in 1881 was there were cowboys in town who were armed. They may have been leaving town. No one was sure. And Virgil was pretty much informed by a couple of his bosses that afternoon that they could send out some armed vigilantes to get rid of these cowboys if the chief of police couldn't do it. Essentially, Virgil was being told, do something, or at the next council meeting, you're not going to have a job anymore. Mm-hmm. He did not want to have to confront the cowboys. He truly believed that if they were just left alone for a little while, they would get on their horses and they would leave town. But he was forced into a situation where he had to do something. His brothers, whom he trusted very much, were there with him. The whole police force at Tombstone was just Virgil and two policemen.
And he had cut the size of the force, right?
Right.
He had
That's how peaceful mm-hmm. things had been in town. Mm-hmm. So he has his brothers to go help him, and Doc Holliday is going to want to go along. Doc Holliday, maybe the worst shot ever on the frontier, handed a shotgun because he might have a better chance if he ever had to shoot of hitting something with that. But they went to Fremont Street in Tombstone to relieve the four cowboys, the two Clantons, the two McClorys of their guns. Ike Clanton was not armed. Tom McClory, one of the two McClory brothers, very likely was not armed either. So you had four armed men against two armed and two unarmed. The cowboys believed that the Earps and Doc Holliday were hounding them, stalking them. They felt backed into a corner. The Earps and Doc Holliday, because of Virgil's situation, are being pressured to do something. Nobody really wants to fight, but you've got eight men in a confined space just a few feet away from each other. They don't trust each other. Each side represents what the other side can't stand. For one side to succeed, the other has to fail. Somebody makes a motion. Everybody decides it must mean the other guy is trying to draw. 30 seconds and 30 shots later, we've had one of the most famous combat events in the history of America.
Jeff Gwynn is my guest. His new book is called The Last Gunfight, The Real Story of the Shootout at the O.K. Corral and How It Changed the American West. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call in now to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Jeff Gwynn. His new book is called The Last Gunfight, the real story of the shootout at the OK Corral and how it changed the American West. Many of us are proud to know that he lives in Fort Worth. If you would like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So there is this weird and enduring famous friendship between Wyatt Earp and Doc Holliday. First of all, what did you learn about why in the world Wyatt Earp in particular remains so loyal to Doc?
That's always been one of the lasting mysteries about not just the OK Corral, but Wyatt Earp's life and Doc's life. They were completely different characters when you think about it. Wyatt wanted to be a respectable lawman, and here his close friend is a hot-tempered, alcoholic, consumptive dentist who actually enjoys looking for trouble sometime. But we were able to get the use of documents that have never before been made available. When Wyatt Earp, in his old age, decided to try to cash in on his legend and write a memoir, he first tried to write it with an engineer friend of his named John Flood. And Flood was an earnest, well-meaning guy, but he couldn't write worth a darn, and the result was unpublishable. But he would go to Wyatt Earp's home and interview Mr. Earp and take copious notes on graph paper because he was an engineer. The Flood notes were kind of like the Holy Grail of Earp research. Everybody had heard about them, but no one knew where they might be. We actually found them. They belonged to a collector who lives just outside of Boston. He's identified in the book, so people can actually check with him, make sure these things existed. And I was able to read the Flood notes. And Wyatt explained here in detail about how Doc Holliday became his friend for life by saving Wyatt in Dodge City from some cowboys Wyatt was trying to arrest who didn't care to be arrested that night. Doc was a gambler. No gambler would jump in and do something like that. Doc just did it. Wyatt was loyal and faithful to him for the rest of their lives together, and the feeling was mutual. Believe it or not, they truly did care for each other and would have sacrificed his life for the other.
And Doc Holliday, as a lot of people know, was trained as a dentist. He was from Atlanta originally?
Yes, and one of the things I love about the book, everybody in Dallas can feel proud that Doc Holliday, for a while, lived and practiced here. Not just that, but next time you go to the State Fair, please know that in 1873, the State Fair honored Doc Holliday and his partner for the best gold teeth made for the fair competition that year, and also the best dentures. It turns out, believe it or not, Doc Holliday was actually a very fine dentist. It's just they like to drink and gamble more.
It's funny to think about him not just being good at what he did, but taking the time to enter a competition at the state fair.
Doc was a competitive sort of guy. He was raised in a very Southern household, and the notion of personal pride and dignity was ingrained in him. He was one of those people who looked for other people to insult him in some way. Mm-hmm. Now, the truth was, he wasn't a very good shot. At one point in his early days in Tombstone, he actually got in a struggle with a saloon owner, had a gun and fired at point-blank range, and he was such a good shot, he actually nicked the man's finger with one of the bullets.
You mentioned, Jeff, that he was probably an alcoholic. Do you think he was mentally as well as physically ill?
We're talking about a man whose mother had been consumptive and had died of the disease. He had seen that happen.
Yeah.
In those days, having tuberculosis was a death sentence, really. You could put it off for a while, but it was coming and he knew it. So there's a certain amount of fatalism involved there anyway. The West was not the violent place we perceive it to be based on movies and TV shows. There wasn't a whole lot of shooting at high noon in Main Street. Just the fact Virgil Earp's in Tombstone with just two policemen as his whole force tell you something. People like Doc got into a lot of trouble and they did it continuously. And there was a certain amount of defeatism in that, I think. Doc probably hoped to go out spectacularly. It didn't happen that way for him. But in the process, he got into an awful lot of scrapes, and I'm sure was a great constant cause of concern to his friend Wyatt.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Tim in Richardson. Hi, Tim.
Hi, how are you? I have a question for Mr. Gwynn, who I used to actually write for, and I can tell you he's not only an excellent writer, but he's an excellent editor also. I used to live in Steubenville, Ohio, and across the street from us lived the Earp sisters, whose names I don't recall at this point, but they lived there with their mother, who had to be 90 years old in the 1970s, and they were related to the Earps. And I don't want to give anything away, but I'm wondering if Mr. Gwynn ran across any information in his research that indicates whether or not the descendants of the Earps and I'm having a brain freeze.
The Clantons.
That's it.
Yeah.
If they have a descendants, and if those descendants have buried the hatchet at this point, and if they all get along now.
Well, I think particularly in the case of a surviving Clanton who likes to go around talking about how the Earps massacred his kin unfairly, there's not much hatchet burying going unless it could be in somebody's skull. Tom and Frank McClory, the McClory brothers who died that day in Tombstone, have a wonderful descendant named Pam Potter, who's the current president of the Wild West History Association. And Pam is very helpful to all distant relatives of all the participants, a very nice lady. And while I was down in Baylor University a couple months ago giving a guest lecture, a young woman came up to me, introduced herself. Her name's Amanda Earp. And just like her great-great-great-great-uncle Wyatt, she's got those pale blue eyes that look at you and you know they mean business. And by the way, it's good to hear from you, Tim. I hope everything's going well with you.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next on the line, we have Shannon in Arlington. Hey, Shannon.
Hi, good afternoon. Earlier in the discussion, your guest mentioned that in the frontier, most of the single women have to prostitute themselves in order to survive. My question is, where did they come from? What was the European background? What part of Europe did they come from? Obviously, they were immigrants. And is there any sources available to know more about them? And I take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Thanks for asking. Actually, a lot of the women were second or third generation.
Prostitutes. Wow.
And the women out in the frontier. Because what would happen is, a young woman might go out with her family. Her parents might get sick. That happened a lot and pass away. There she would be. A woman might be widowed. When you're out there on the frontier and you're trying to survive, your choices in those days were not great for a woman. The image of the school teacher and, just winning the heart of the sheriff, I suppose that happened once or twice, but Wyatt Earp, again, is a good case in point, as is his brother James, that the women they end up with as common law wives were former prostitutes. That's what the supply of women were for men who weren't upper class, who could import their brides from the coast or something.
So either you came with a wife from the place you originated or you relied on prostitutes.
Pretty much. Mm-hmm. And that sounds awful. And it was awful for women. My heart broke for seeing some of these descriptions. You can find a lot of information about frontier women. Since you're from Arlington, contact the Texas State Historical Society. They will have articles and information and can send you to experts on the subject.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. So let's talk about what exactly preceded the shootout at the OK Corral. First of all, I was really surprised, and you've made this point already, that it was not a matter of people whipping out their guns at all times. And in fact, the debates about whether people should be allowed to carry weapons, whether they ought to be concealed or open, were absolutely as strong in 1881 as they remain today.
Again, you're going to find so many similarities in the atmosphere, in the cultural divides, Tombstone in 1881, America in 2011. The showdown, such as it was, really started months and months earlier. Wyatt Earp was very ambitious. He wants to be elected county sheriff. They've just formed Cochise County, and one of Wyatt's arch-democratic rivals, Johnny Behan, has been named Cochise County Sheriff by the governor. There's going to be an election in another year. In March of 1881, the Benson stage is robbed, and a driver named Bud Philpott is shot and killed. This is such a rare event, an actual death in a stage holdup. Wells Fargo offers, at the time, amazing rewards for the three fugitives, $1,200 each. Johnny Behan can't catch these guys. Wyatt Earp thinks if he can capture them, that gives him a huge advantage in the election that will be coming up. But the cowboys don't trust him, so Wyatt decides to enlist a friend of the fugitives in a plot to trick them into coming back where Wyatt can catch them. And that person Wyatt approaches is Ike Clanton. The plot doesn't work out because the three robbers and murderers end up getting shot themselves in various parts of the country. But Ike becomes terrified that Wyatt is going to start telling about the whole plan and that Ike would cooperate with him.
It would ruin both of their reputations.
Yes, but in Ike's case, he thought that the Texas cowboys, the friends of the robbers, would then come and kill Ike. Mm-hmm. Ike is paranoid. He is a drunk. He is one of those people that says a lot more than he should ever say. And the night before the shootout, he's accusing Wyatt of telling Doc Holliday all about the plot and making it public, and gets drunk and says in the morning he will get his guns and he will deal with Doc Holliday. In fact, he'll deal with the Earps. Virgil Earp could have arrested Ike. But this is one of those typical happenings in a frontier boomtown. Some guy has a little too much to drink. He says a bunch of stuff. He goes home. He sleeps it off. Everything's forgotten in the morning.
Stuff like that probably happened twice a week.
Probably happened twice a night.
Yeah.
But Virgil Earp, Ike Clanton, and Tom McClory, and Johnny Behan end up playing poker all night long till dawn. The game breaks up. Everybody's been drinking. And as Virgil's trying to go home and go to bed, Ike calls out after him, "You'd better carry my message to Doc Holliday," and then adds that the Earps will have to fight too. Virgil is perfectly within his rights at this point to pistol whip Ike, drag him off to jail. But he just tells, "Oh, go away, you know, go sleep it off." Ike instead goes to get his rifle and pistol that he had to check when he came to town earlier that day. He keeps drinking, and he starts wandering the streets, informing everybody that he's going to kill the Earps and Doc Holliday whenever he spots them. Somebody tells Virgil and Wyatt. Ike is settled down by being buffaloed, a pistol butt to the skull, dragged into day court, fined $25. His guns are taken away from him again by Virgil, who says, "Where do you want me to check these for you so you can get them when you leave town?" Wyatt, in a terrible mood afterward, because he and Ike have been yelling at each other in the court, encounters Tom McClory, who'd come to town with Ike the day before. Tom wants to know where Ike is. Wyatt takes real offense at that and buffaloes Tom, leaving him dripping blood on the ground. So you've got the two cowboys, either of whom may have been concussed. Ike's still drunk. Unfortunately for everybody, it escalates because Doc Holliday hears about what's been going on and decides he'll get dressed and go downstairs and see what's happening. Billy Clanton and Frank McClory ride into town to see their brothers. They hear what happened. They just want to get their brothers out of town. We don't want any more trouble. But there's the macho thing. There's the public image. The cowboys don't want to slink out of town and everybody think the Earps drove them out.
Mm-hmm.
So the Earps and Doc are in a saloon waiting for the cowboys to go. Virgil's getting pressured by the town leaders to do something. The cowboys slowly walk through the OK Corral. They're collecting their horses and making sure they don't hurry out of town. And they even talk loudly among themselves what they're going to do if the Earps bother them anymore. But they're basically trying to leave. Ike doesn't have any weapons. Tom probably doesn't. Johnny Behan inserts himself in the problem by saying, "Well, the cowboys trust him. He'll go talk to them and take their guns." He leaves to go talk to them. the cowboys stop because a butcher wants to talk to the McClorys about some beef. There's a contract they need. And so they're waiting by this vacant lot out on Fremont Street. Up come the Earps. They find that the cowboys still have their guns. Well, there's a crowd gathered. They've got to go take the guns now. The cowboys think they're being stalked by the Earps who are pursuing them when there's no need. We're on our way out. The gunfight ensues. When it's over, Ike Clanton has run away and hidden. The other three cowboys are dead. Virgil Earp's been shot in the leg. Doc Holliday's been grazed in the hip. Morgan Earp's been shot through both shoulders. And based on another new diagram from the collector in Boston that Wyatt drew of the gunfight itself, it shows there's even the possibility that Wyatt accidentally shot Morgan.
Were you surprised when you looked at that document and said, based on the positions here, this is how it must have happened?
Well,
or may have happened?
It may have happened. I personally think it probably did. And the diagram was drawn by Wyatt. It's not like somebody else did it for him. Let's face it, 30 seconds, point-blank range, people shooting at each other. Everything must have been confusing. And it could have happened that way. What we do know is the only one who escaped that fight without a scratch was Wyatt Earp.
Who fired first?
We don't know. Wyatt told a couple different versions overall. Based on court testimony, there was a hearing after the shootout to see whether the Earps and Doc should be tried for murder. And then there was the vendetta ride with Wyatt,
right,
avenging one brother's murder and another's crippling by the cowboys. We have a pretty good idea that Frank McClory, Billy Clanton, and Wyatt were probably the first ones to get their guns out. But there's conflicting testimony. I'm pretty sure that they couldn't even have told you. I mean, things must have been happening so fast, and people made some mistakes. The whole idea was to arrest them or take their weapons. It was not a calculated duel between good and evil, black hats versus white hats. It was an arrest gone wrong between eight men who distrusted each other.
My guest is Jeff Gwynn. His new book is called The Last Gunfight, The Real Story of the Shootout at the OK Corral and How It Changed the American West. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Jeff Gwynn. His newest book is called The Last Gunfight, The Real Story of the Shootout at the OK Corral and How It Changed the American West. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Obviously, Jeff, for people who are curious about the world, a good story is always a good story. But why do we still care so much about this story?
I think the OK Corral is one of the three iconic battle events in American history that's just become part of our culture. It's infused in us. The Alamo, mm-hmm. Custer's Last Stand, the gunfight at the OK Corral. How many times have you heard a football coach say, we won a close one, it was just like the OK Corral?
But they're all such disasters.
Well, I will say this for the OK Corral. Unlike Custer and Davy Crockett, Wyatt Earp lived.
Mm-hmm.
They are disasters. In a way, we're drawn to it. People watch car wrecks. But to me, the real significance of the OK Corral comes in two ways. It really did change things. The first, less obvious now, more so at the time, was that the Earps and Doc Holliday did have to go to court to defend their actions. You couldn't have a clearer signal that on the frontier, even lawmen would have to behave responsibly, and if they did not, face the consequences for that. And afterward, after the Vendetta ride, Wyatt and Doc and some people who were riding with them were fugitives who expected the territorial governor to pardon them. He never did. Mm-hmm. So there's that. But to me, even more significant, the OK Corral and its mythology over the years really became much of the basis for a lot of people's belief that the Old West was a black and white, one-dimensional place where good always triumphed over evil and men wore their guns and weren't afraid to use them and did on frequent occasions. It gives us a very skewed view. The history of the West, the history of the frontier, is multidimensional. It's fascinating. There's so much more to it than a lot of people realize. I'm writing this book for the general audience that would like to know more about these things. And hopefully it'll be the impetus for them to go on to look at other books, maybe to study the West, to see it in a different light. It was so much greater, so much better than a lot of us know. I think I learned more in writing this book than any of my others, and it was just an amazing experience.
You mentioned that they were held accountable by the law. Of course, there was also the court of public opinion and the newspapers. And by the way, it's a fabulous detail that one of Tombstone's papers was called the Daily Epitaph.
Yes, it was.
How did that split? Was it politically split down the middle?
The two newspapers in Tombstone, the Epitaph was Republican. It was owned by John Clum, the town mayor. The Nugget was Democrat. So one side was for the Earps, one side was for the Cowboys. What shocked the Earps the day after the gunfight, because they believed they would be seen by the town as heroes, over 2,000 people lined the streets for the McClory-Clanton funeral. And that was before word got out to all the small ranchers in the area about the shooting. Public sympathy was not with the Earps. The town leaders sympathize, but when they began to see the way the general public was feeling, the Earps actually felt betrayed by the people they thought they were representing.
1-800-933-5372. Our next phone caller is Randy in Arlington. Hi, Randy.
Hi. I'd like to ask the writer, does he have any information on two members of the Cowboys that were portrayed prominently in the movie Tombstone? One was Curly Bill, and the other was Johnny Ringo, who they portrayed in the movie, at least, as a fast draw.
We've got quite a bit on both Curly Bill and Johnny Ringo. The Cowboys had no acknowledged leaders as such, but Curly Bill and John Ringo really were the ones who stood out more than any others. Ringo had a pretty bad temper, but he was an educated man. He was one of the few cowboys who read books. On the other hand, one night he invited a fellow to have a drink with him. The guy said he didn't feel like drinking, and Ringo shot him through the neck. So you have to be careful. Ringo died under mysterious circumstances not long after the shootout. Some people believe he committed suicide. Others think Wyatt did it. Others think Doc Holliday did it, and so on. Curly Bill, who went by a lot of different names, but Curly Bill Brocious is the best known one, had a lot of confrontation with Wyatt prior to the shootout and afterward on the Vendetta ride. Curly Bill and some cowboys met Wyatt and his friends. Gunshots were exchanged. Some people have it Curly Bill died that day, others that he rode away untouched. They are colorful characters. The cast in this book is as eclectic and unique as you can possibly want.
There were, was it five Earp brothers or six?
Well, there were four Earp brothers who were more or less involved in Tombstone.
Right,
another
right.
one, a younger one, came later, and there was yet another brother who was a farmer in California and back in Kansas.
Did you get a sense for what their personal relationships were like and how they sort of dealt with one another? And Virgil was the older brother, eldest
they
brother?
They were, James was the oldest.
Okay.
The Earps were a close-knit family. An attack on one to them was an attack on all of them. But it was that way with many families on the frontier, particularly when you're out, say, in a mining community where everybody is your competitor for what you're trying to do. You could trust your family, even if you couldn't trust anybody else, because the same family bond was present for the Clantons and for the McClories. And again, that's something people forget. There were three sets of brothers involved in the events that day. And the brothers in each case were close.
Yeah, it's interesting when you think about that because, you know, even if your brother has done something wrong, your impulse is to protect him.
Of course. And that was the way it was for the Earps. They protected each other sometimes in questionable ways, but they loved each other.
And is it true that Virgil once arrested Wyatt for disturbing the peace?
And Wyatt had to pay a fine. Virgil tried to call it down the middle, even if the cowboys didn't believe it.
Mm-hmm. So what happened to them after this time? You mentioned that they were fugitives once again.
Virgil Earp was a cripple. He tried to do some detecting, some law enforcement. He ran bars and theaters. James Earp ended up driving a taxi in Los Angeles. Morgan, of course, died in ambush. Wyatt and his final common-law wife, Josephine. Josephine claimed later that they were married and named the place and the boat on which they were married, except the boat wasn't built until a couple of years after that. A small detail. Prospected all over the country. They spent quite a bit of time in Alaska. But Wyatt and Josephine ended up living in genteel poverty. Wyatt frustrated in his ambitions to be a great and famous man. He lived long enough to see his old buddy Bat Masterson, who reinvented himself as a journalist in the East, make a good living writing about the West, including about Wyatt. He did not know that Wyatt, shortly after his death, that Stuart Lake would publish a book that would eventually become the basis for all the Earpian mythology. And as I closed The Last Gunfight and said in print and would say now, Wyatt would have liked everything about the way it turned out, except he didn't make any money from it.
Did Josephine realize a significant sum from all that?
Josephine could have. She was what we would now call high maintenance all her life. And she attempted to whitewash everything about Wyatt's checkered past and her own to the point of threatening to sue movie makers who weren't adhering to the story the way she wanted it told. She did make some money. She also had a gambling habit. And she ended up pretty much living on the charity of family.
Why is it Wyatt Earp who's famous and the other brothers are sort of side characters? You know, maybe second is Virgil and then Morgan's in there a little bit. And what is it about Wyatt?
Bat Masterson.
Mm-hmm. Because he wrote about him.
Right. He was the first one to write about them and to write about Wyatt Earp, the bravest and most courageous lawman he ever saw out on the frontier. Really, when you think about what a lot of people know of the gunfight, it's almost as though Doc Holliday and Wyatt Earp shot it out with the Clantons. Mm-hmm. You don't hear the McClory's name. You really don't hear much about Virgil or Morgan anymore.
It's hard to believe that that was just 30 seconds, maybe because every movie depiction stretches it into minutes upon minutes, but 30 seconds is nothing.
You've got to remember, it built up over many, many years of frustration with politics, with economics. If it hadn't happened there with those men, it would have happened somewhere else. And the combustible elements just came together in one place. That's usually the way these iconic moments happen. If Virgil had just arrested Ike the night before, put him in jail to sleep it off, who knows?
Let's go back to the fate of our other favorite character, the city of Tombstone. Why did it not continue to prosper into the 20th century?
The mines flooded, and the price of silver on the open market dropped, so you couldn't make a profit trying to pump out the mines and keep working. Most boom towns, mining towns, had a shelf life of no more than 3 years. In a couple of cases, that didn't happen, but Tombstone was left out there in the San Pedro Valley. When the first books came out with Wyatt, the movie, suddenly Tombstone, what a great name for a town, saw a way to reinvent itself. I know that a lot of the people living in town now will not like my book because they sell the mythology of the gunfight, and you can't blame them. They're trying to survive. Economic times are hard. But the fact remains that the gunfight, as it's presented when it's acted out in Tombstone every day, it's pretty questionable that, well, they have added a lot of dramatic license. A lot of the sophisticated things about the town that would amaze and I think thrill a lot of people aren't in evidence. But when you go to Disneyland, you know you're not really being greeted by a giant mouse. when you go to Tombstone, if you realize you're just having some fun with the mythology, I don't see any problem with it, and it doesn't hurt anyone.
Let's go to the phones one last time here, and we have Frank on the line in North Richland Hills. Hey, Frank. Hello, Frank.
Oh, yes.
Go right ahead,
hey,
please.
Jeff. I've been exchanging some emails with Bud Kennedy in reference to the connection that the McLowrys had to Fort Worth.
Yes.
And that was the fact that one of the McLowry brothers was actually a lawyer here in Fort Worth and eventually a judge in Fort Worth.
Will McLowry.
And he actually spent, my understanding is, his fortune in an effort to prosecute the Earps.
Will McLowry came to Tombstone for the what was called the Spicer hearing because of the Justice of the Peace Spicer, determined to see the Earps and Doc Holliday hang for the murder of his brothers. If he had pursued a lesser charge, manslaughter, for instance, he might have been able to convince the judge that the case should go to trial. But Will, a very intelligent, dynamic man, was so blinded by anger that he pushed for too much. And ultimately, the Earps and Doc Holliday were exonerated by Spicer. There's some talk that McLowry may have funded the ambushes on the Earp brothers ever since. There's never been any documentation of that, and I personally don't believe it. Will McLowry was a man who believed in the law. He simply wanted it enforced.
What sort of, I mean, do you, like, start to laugh? Do you kind of shout when you find something that you know has not been published before?
Well, first, I doubt it.
Mm-hmm.
You have to check the provenance of everything.
Yeah.
And in every book I write, yeah, I've been fortunate to discover new things, but I've come across things that look great and when they were tested turned out not to be. But when you do have those thank you Jesus moments, as some of us old journalists like to call them, it's a wonderful thing. And you hope that what you're doing is moving history a little bit more forward. There's never going to be any definitive book of nonfiction because there's always new material, new evidence to be discovered. 5 years from now, 10 years, somebody else is going to want to write about this, and he or she will think to look somewhere that I didn't. And God bless them. We're all just trying to contribute our share. And I would hope with this book, in terms of the mythology and the truth of the last gunfight, that I was able to do that.
How do you divide your time when you're writing between research and writing itself? Are you doing both at the same time?
These books are usually 2.5 to 3 year projects. Mm-hmm. I will spend the first year doing nothing but research. Then I'll start to write. But as I start to write, then I'll see all the things I need to research more. And the research continues right up to the moment when my editor in New York says, sorry, it's got to go to press.
Jeff Gwynn's new book is called The Last Gunfight, The Real Story of the Shootout at the OK Corral and How It Changed the American West. Jeff, it is always a pleasure to have you on. The new book is really interesting. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
It's fun to be with you and with your listeners.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.